Okay, we are in Hebrews chapter 11, and we're going to look at three people tonight, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And the focus here is going to be the fact that they all had faith at the point of death or all the way through their life. As we're talking here, the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, is talking about them having faith and being able to endure. And the fact that Abraham endured, we talked about him, and he went through many things maintaining his faith. But then he handed it down to Isaac, and Isaac, upon his death, never saw the promises fulfilled, but yet passed the blessing down to his son. And Jacob, upon his death, passed it down to his sons, and so it continues all the way to Joseph, or Joseph himself. When he was going to die, he says, take me back to the promised land. So the promise made to Abraham is going to go through four generations. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and then to Joseph and the other sons, all waiting but never really receiving the promise. And again, the promise basically was the land and the nation, that they're going to become a great people and that they're going to occupy the land. Abraham, of course, who went through him, was looking for something more than just the land. He was looking for, like we talked about, the heavenly city. Well, we are in chapter 11. I'll just read through these verses and then we'll kind of start breaking them down. We're going back to a lot of time in Genesis and just kind of filling these up. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 20, after finishing with Abraham, it says, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. Verse 21. By faith Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. Verse 22. By faith Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. And then next week, verse 23, we'll begin talking about Moses. Let's bow our heads, I'll pray, and we'll look at these things. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the chance to be here. We do this that we may hear and understand the scriptures, that we may ourselves grow in faith and learn what is expected of us as Christians and as believers living at this time in history. Again, we thank you for the chance to be here, and I thank you for the people here. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. One thing that is unique about Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph in these three very quick verses is they've got chapters. The second half of Genesis is all about them. And so, I mean, the details of Joseph's life from the time he was 17 up until he was 110, the details of his life are given, I mean, conversations. And all it says here is it mentions the end of his life. Again, why that is there, because the focus is that these people endured their entire life, and upon dying, they still were believing and waiting, so confident that they had the promise to the next generation. But of course, we could talk a lot about each of these people. Let's go to go back to Genesis right away. And the thing about Isaac, nothing is said about him being bound on the altar. Nothing is said about him being deceived. But Isaac, of course, is unique in the sense that he's got two sons, Esau and Jacob. And he's going to speak to both of them about their futures. Of course, Jacob is going to get both the birthright and the blessing. And there is a distinction between that, as you probably know. I think I've got written down here somewhere the verses. Birthright, chapter 25, Jacob, as you know, Jacob deceives Esau and gets the birthright. And the birthright was basically the inheritance of the oldest son. He got the property, all the possessions. He got the firstborn share of the physical property. And that's when Esau gave it up. It's interesting that possibly Esau's character is shown in that we think, oh, poor Esau got ripped off. Poor Esau got deceived. Isaac got deceived. Well, Jacob here, of course, is at some point is a believer. At some level, in the sense that a believer in the promise, so much so that he's willing to steal or lie or deceive for it. We're not saying he's ethical. We're not saying he's got good character. We're not saying that he's Christ-like. But we can say that Jacob has some kind of confidence or faith that he wants that blessing and he wants the birthright. He knows something big is going to happen and he wants to be in the middle of it. Esau, if you remember, when they go out to, in chapter 25, he's been out hunting a long time. He's hungry, comes back, and says, give me some of the stew. And Joseph or Jacob says, give me your birthright. Well, Esau says, well, what good is my birthright if I'm dead? Here, take it. And later on in Hebrews here, we're going to come up to, and they're going to warn us not to be like Esau, who, I'm trying to see it here real quickly. I should have said that. Where's it at? It tells us not to be like Esau, who sold his birthright, who was sexually immoral. Where is it? It's got to be chapter 13. I'm just looking for it right here.
12:16.
12:16? Yeah, there it is. It says, chapter 12, verse 16, "See that no one is sexually immoral or is godless like Esau, who for a single meal sold his inheritance," or birthright, "sold his inheritance rights as the oldest son." In other words, he compared the future blessing. I mean, this is a physical thing. The birthright or the inheritance was he could actually see it. I mean, it would have been Isaac's possessions, and Isaac obviously probably wasn't a very poor man because his father was Abraham, and he inherited the entire estate. So Isaac is a fairly wealthy man with some physical evidence of that wealth right there. Esau could physically see it, but for some reason, well, it says he was godless, he was immoral. Something was wrong in his thinking that he couldn't wait for what was obviously his and was willing to sell the rights to it for a bowl of soup, instant gratification. And that kind of describes Esau's character, but it also reveals Jacob's, not just his trickery or his sharpness, but his willingness to say, you know what, I want what is offered to you. And he was wondering, or maybe could judge his character, realize, I can judge Esau's character, no, I can get this from him for a bowl of soup. And so he got the birthright at that time, Genesis chapter 25. Later on, Isaac is who obviously believes in the promise, and we can't negate this by saying, well, he was deceived. He still believed the promise, because when he blesses Jacob in a deceived state, he still believed he was giving it to somebody. He really believed the promise. So it's clear that he believes it. But Esau's behavior concerning the birthright may have set the stage for the actual, what we call now, in this text, the blessing. And the blessing is not the same as the birthright. The blessing would then be the promises given to Abraham, the land, the becoming of the great nation. It's the spiritual promise. The birthright was what Isaac could offer him. The blessing was what God, the Father God, could offer him. And he despised what his physical father had to offer him. So I understand it makes sense that he would have absolutely no concept of what to do with the spiritual blessing. And Jacob was willing to get this birthright, and with the help of his mother was willing to get the blessing. Deceitful in both cases, but again, Esau was willing to sacrifice the birthright, and so, of course, probably didn't have regard for the blessing. So anyway, we've got that happening right here. Let's go back to chapter 27 of Genesis. And we got the situation here where we're going to have, again, you know the story. Isaac says, I'm going to give Esau the blessing. He thinks he's going to die. He says, I'm near my death. The thing is, he's going to live for another 20-some years. He's not nearly as close to death as he thought he was. But he's going to give the blessing. He's going to give it to Esau. He says, Esau, go get me something to eat. You know, go out and hunt something. Come in, prepare a meal for me, and I'll give you the blessing. As you know, in chapter 27, this is where Rebekah, Jacob, and Esau's mom comes and says, Jacob, come here. And tells him, you've got to do this thing. I'll get the food ready. You get yourself dressed up. Go in there and deceive your father. Now, by the time Jacob returns from Padan Aram, or Aram, he's going to go up north, up to where Syria is at, up in that area. By the time he gets back, his mom's dead. He'll never see his mom again. But when he gets back, his father is still alive, and he's around for his father's last days. And, of course, you know, he meets Esau. But here we go. We are in chapter 27. Let's begin in verse 14, if you don't mind. So he went and got them and brought them to his mother, and she prepared some tasty food, just as the way his father liked it. Then Rebekah took the best clothes of Esau, her older son, which she had in the house, and put them on her younger son, Jacob. She also covered his hands with smooth and the smooth part of his neck with the goat skins. And she handed to her son, Jacob, the tasty food and the bread she had made. He went to his father and said, My father? Yes, my son. He answered, Who is it? Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now, in a sense, he's not Esau, and he's not the firstborn, but he is the one that he's bought the right, in a sense, to be here. He bought the right to be here with a bowl of soup. Now, we're not giving Jacob, you know, a lenience here, but, you know, he's not the firstborn, but he is the one who has inherited or has bought the right to be in this position. Please sit up and eat some of my game so you may give me your blessing. I mean, if Jacob's completely on the up and up and really wants to be honest, he'd say, hey, I bought the right to be here. I'm Jacob, and I bought the right to be Esau here today. Isaac asked his son, "How did you find it so quickly, my son? The Lord, your God, gave me success." Recognizing the God of Isaac. Maybe indicating it's not quite the God of Jacob yet. That's later to come in the story of Genesis. Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near so I can touch you." Obviously, Isaac is a little suspicious. "My son, to know me, touch you, so to know whether you really are my son Esau or not." Remember, Isaac's having a hard time seeing. Verse 22, Jacob went close to his father Isaac, who touched him and said, "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him, for his hands were hairy like those of his brother Esau, so he blessed him. Are you really my son Esau?" "I am," he replied. Then he said, "My son, bring me some of your game to eat, so I may give you my blessing." Jacob brought it, some kind of little ritual going here. Jacob brought it to him, and he ate, and he brought some of wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come here, my son, and kiss me." So he went to him, kissed him. When Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, still suspicious, he blessed him and said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed." And here comes the blessing, the next two verses. And this right here is Isaac blessing Jacob. Again, in a deceived state, most likely. Yeah, pretty clearly he's deceived. But at the same time, completely having faith, that's the focus of the book of Hebrews, completely having faith in the promise of Abraham. "May God give you of heaven's dew and earth's riches, and abundance of grain and new wine." There's the physical blessing. "May nations serve you and peoples bow down to you." Now we're talking about nations. "Be Lord over your brothers, and may the sons of your mother bow down to you. May those who curse you be cursed, and those who bless you be blessed." Very similar to Abraham's blessing. After Isaac finished blessing him and Jacob had scarcely left his father's presence, his brother Esau came in from hunting. He too prepared some tasty food and brought it to his father. Then he said to him, "My father, sit up and eat some of my game so that you may give me your blessing." His father Isaac asked him, Who are you?" "I'm your son," he answered, "your firstborn, Esau." Isaac trembled violently because he had just, it was like, well, that doesn't count, I would cancel that blessing out. He had spoken the blessing of Abraham to Jacob, and it was a done deal. History had just turned. History had just pivoted towards Jacob's favor. And Isaac, how much did Isaac understand this? How much faith did Isaac have in that blessing? So much so that when he realized he gave it to the wrong person, he began to shake. It had a physical reaction to him, meaning he believed the blessing. "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? I ate just before you came and I blessed him. And indeed, he will be blessed." See, indeed, he will be blessed. Those weren't empty words I was speaking. "When Esau heard his father's words, he burst out with a loud and bitter cry." He also realizes what has taken place. "And said to his father, 'Bless me.' 'Me too, my father.' But he said, 'Your brother came deceitfully and took your blessing.' Esau said, 'Isn't he rightfully named Jacob?'" Deceiver. "He has deceived me these two times, birth and inheritance and blessing. He took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing." Then he asked, now remember, he didn't take his birthright. He bought it at a wicked deal, but it was still an agreement that Esau willing, in fact, history records in Hebrews. He sold it for a bowl of soup. Dumb deal, but he did it. "And now he's taken my blessing." Then he asked, "Haven't you reserved any blessing for me?" Isaac answered Esau. Now this word says in Hebrews, it says he spoke of Esau and Jacob's future. Jacob got the blessing, but the future, speaking of the future, is still coming. "I have made him lord over you, and have made all his relatives his servants, and have sustained him with grain and new wine." Meaning I've given him physical provisions. "So what can I possibly do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Do you have only one blessing, my father? Bless me too, my father." Then Esau wept aloud. His father Isaac answered him. And here it is now speaking about Esau's future. If you take the blessing out, this is what's left. "Your dwelling will be away from the earth's riches," or richness, "away from the dew of the heaven above." There's your no wine, no grain. "You will live by the sword, and you will serve your brother." Now, you will live by the sword, meaning if you don't have crops, if you don't have grain, if you don't have the rain or the wine, how are you going to survive? Well, plunder, looting, you're going to live by the sword. Someone else is going to raise it, and your only hope of surviving is to invade them and take what they've got. You will live by the sword. And notice it says, you will live. You will thrive. You will survive as a looter. And you will serve your brother. But when you grow restless, you will throw his yoke from off of your neck. Esau held a grudge against his brother Jacob. It goes on like that. So if you look down here, I got some notes written here. Jacob also spoke to Esau about his future, about the middle of that first page. Esau would not have the rich produce of the land, but will live as a predator by maintaining his existence by war and plunder. And you can see this throughout the Old Testament that's continuing. Yet Esau will never conquer his brother Jacob. Never. And here's a map very quickly, so you understand this. Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. This is taking place right about in Hebron, right about in here. This land down in this area here is the land of Edom. Edom is, it's Esau, no doubt about it. That's Esau. It's the same word. And so Edom is where he's from at. And Edom is going to always be subject to Israel or to Judah. I've got two things written down here. We can look these things up. Esau will first revolt against Jacob, or Israel, the nation of Israel, during the days of Solomon in 1 Kings 11. They have a revolt and are subdued, but they do try to throw the shackles off. And then finally in Jehoram's day, after they've already split, got Israel up here, Judah down here, then they do actually throw off and separate in 2 Kings chapter 8, and Edom does separate from them at that time. Now, what is, as this continues through history, Babylon comes in, of course, takes Judah, Assyria disperses Israel, the northern ten, and then 586 B.C., Judah's taken into captivity. Edom, in a sense, is overrun also, and the prophets speak about that, of them, they're rejoicing. When Jerusalem fell, these guys, Edom, was excited. They're like, yeah, finally, it's our chance. Well, the prophet Obadiah warns them, going, don't get too excited, because they're coming after you next. Because you rejoice with the destruction of Jerusalem, God's coming after you through Babylon. By the time we get through the silent 400 years and Rome has come in, there's a group of people, not a group of people, but a man, I forget his name, but it was Herod's father, makes a deal with Rome and comes up and begins to rule this area as one of the leaders and hands Galilee to his son, gets his son, who's in his 20s, the rulership of the land of Galilee. His name was Herod. And when Antipater, that was his name, Antipater was an Edomian or an Edomite. When Antipater dies, Herod convinces Rome to give him the land right here. And Herod is an Edomite, a descendant of Esau, ruling Jerusalem and ruling Judea. And of course, the Jews, Israel, never, never let him forget it. And no matter what is said about Herod, we know we got a little bit in the Bible about Herod. We need to spend some time someday talking about Herod. Fantastic, fantastic individual, brilliant, understood man or men, understood power. He did several things. One, he would never let his image, I've got a coin upstairs from the days of Herod, and it's a coin minted by Herod, but it doesn't have his image on it. He never had to let his image be put on a Jewish coin. Why? The Jews never wanted any images, of course, no graven images. They always have like a horn of plenty, cornucopia, palm trees, things like this. But he never put his image on coins. Twice, because of famine, Israel was starving. And two different times, Herod sold all of his possessions. I mean, took the royal couches and put them out on the garage sale and took the money, went down to Egypt where there was grain, and brought it back and fed the people. Now, it was a government program. But it wasn't a government program like we know. It was a government program where the king went into bankruptcy so that he could feed the people, because if he didn't feed the people, they were going to revolt and he would no longer be king. How bad did Herod want to be king? Very bad. Of course, he had caravan routes running through the land, and he quickly made the money back, but twice had to sell it. So there's many things that Herod did that were fantastic, including bringing peace to the land, and he was, again, one of the Edomites. And that all kind of figures into this whole thing. Herod came the closest, but he was, in a sense, a puppet king under Rome. I'll say this and then I'll quit about Herod. You remember the Roman War, the Civil War, after Julius Caesar was stabbed. You've got his adopted son, Octavian. and one of his friends, Mark Anthony. And these two end up dividing the kingdom, dividing Rome into a civil war. Mark Antony comes down here and sides with Cleopatra of Egypt, and was friends, and had, through that time during Julius Caesar's time, Julius Caesar and Herod were friends. Julius Herod sides with Cleopatra and Mark Antony, and they fight to the bitter death. And of course, as you remember, Mark Antony and Cleopatra both end up dying, and Octavian wins and is recognized by the Senate as the new emperor, what they call him, Caesar Augustus, the exalted one. And Octavian becomes Caesar Augustus that we see in the time of Christ being born. Well, of course, Herod, who didn't get killed in the Civil War but pumped a bunch of money and support for Mark Antony, is called to Rome. And why is he called to Rome? To have his kingdom removed. He is going to be probably exiled and removed, and Herod knows this. But one of the signs, and Herod had done this so many times as he goes through Herod's life, he takes a difficult situation and spins it around. He's called into Rome and appears before now Caesar Augustus, Octavian, Julius Caesar's adopted son, his nephew. And says, you supported my enemy. And Herod says, well, he says, I'm faithful. Mark Antony was my friend. And I will always support my friends to the very end. Now, you could be my friend, Caesar. And Caesar goes, And Herod comes back with more authority and more power, and that is where you end up with Herod still being on the throne and being friends with Caesar Augustus all the way through, and had building projects. His imprint on Judea you can still see it. We saw this last summer. We saw painted walls on Masada that were painted by Herod's people. You could still see the paint. We were in a bath, a dome bath. They could still see the mosaics on the tile on the side of the wall that's still there 2,000 years later. If you can still see it today, are you going to still be able to see paint on my walls in 2,000 years? No. And yeah, they won't even be able to locate this house in 2,000 years. But in other words, Herod, and there's so many things we could go off on Herod, and Herod's just studying himself. Indeed, he was a man of the world. He was a man who was there for himself, but he understood history, he understood power, and he executed some brilliant things. But, in a sense, he ruled for Rome. He ruled for Rome. He was not an independent king. He was Rome's king, which is obvious because Octavian could have had him exiled or decapitated or something, but sent him back with more authority. Very interesting story, but nonetheless, he does come out of this group called the Edomites, or Esau, that we see right here. Going on with the notes right here, just mentioned a little bit about the birthright and the blessing, and it comes next now to, after Isaac, the promise went from Abraham to Isaac, who clearly believed on it, and spoke of both Esau and Jacob's future. Jacob was the blessing. Esau was, his future was still spoken about, and again, it followed that throughout history. Now, Jacob, it says here on your notes on page 1 there, it says when he was dying, once again, when he was dying, at the end of his life, Abraham didn't see it, but told his son Isaac. Did Isaac believe it? So much so that even on his death, he was still confirming it all the way up to Jacob. Jacob now is going to take it, and he's got the 12 sons of Jacob. We got all the stories of Jacob's sons, including Joseph. You got the story of Jacob coming back from Paddan Aram up north, meeting Esau. Some great stories there. We're not going to go through all of them, obviously. But Jacob comes down. He's going to end up with 12 sons. We got Joseph and 11 other sons that he's going to have. Joseph being picked out by the writer of Hebrews as significant, and we'll show you why. Because Joseph is going to have two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh are two sons, and they're going to be talking about them here in just a moment. But Jacob, it says here, while he was dying, he blessed each of Joseph's sons. So go to Genesis chapter 28, and now you've just skipped 20 chapters, so you understand how much... 48. Yeah, thank you, 48. You just skipped 20 chapters, so you see how much material we've actually gone through. And here is, I don't know, I'm thinking about breezing through this. Please, yes.
Can you explain to the blessing? I think mm-hmm. the blessings is coming from God.
Right.
But I maybe never understood, how he knew he was to give a blessing why that held like it did versus us saying, well, God bless you.
Right.
You know, I mean,
right.
It seemed like it was specifically directed.
Maybe it would be, again, I don't want to change the words, but the idea when it says blessing and we trace it back, what he's simply doing is handing down the promise. And God gave Abraham a promise that he was going to become a mighty nation,
right,
that he was going to inherit the land. But the problem then becomes, you've got Ishmael, you've got Keturah's sons, and so now, they all, I mean, this thing's going to start to multiply. Pretty soon, you know, the whole world's going to have the blessing of Abraham. And
okay,
through faith, of course, that we got something else happening there in,
okay,
Galatians. But this physical blessing has to go through a line. And so it could be, well, it's not even, the thing is, it's not Abraham's choice. Because who did Abraham choose? Do you remember when we went through, who did Abraham choose? Who says, it's good enough, I'm going to bless who? Ishmael. Abraham is my son, I'm going to give it to Ishmael. God says, no, it's going to be Isaac. So Ishmael was canceled out, not because of any reason, I mean, we talk about a variety of things, but God chose which way is going to, by the time Keturah's sons get here, it's too late, the blessing's already gone to Isaac. So God, this promise, the blessing could almost be the promise, or it's going to be the line that's going to receive, that down here is going to receive the land, and they're going to be the nation of Israel, whatever it ends up being. So I think it's almost like a promise, almost like choosing who's going to, we can say it this way, the birthright was, again, the money, the physical blessing of the father, that the father has built this estate and he's going to hand it down to Isaac, who then can choose Esau or Jacob. But really, Isaac can't choose. He's got to give the birthright to the firstborn son if he's going to remain culturally and in their way they do things, legally binding. So he's got to give it over here. So Isaac couldn't even choose. He just had to send the birthright or the physical blessing here. And the same thing, the blessing or the promise would have to come then to one of these two, and most likely to Esau. Because of the situation, you know, we read about being deceived and deceived and stuff, Jacob wants that and gets the promise and the birthright. So now the money and the promise of becoming the nation and the land is going to come now through Jacob. So the blessing is mainly, it's more like the promise. Because it's not like now Jacob says, I don't have any other blessing to give you. Meaning he can never be nice to anybody ever again or do something. It's like, I think he's saying that this is the promise. There's going to only be one son become that nation. And it's going to come on down through here. Now when it gets down to these 12 sons, I said 48, I mean 49. We're going to run through these 12 sons, I think, real quickly and see how each of them is going to be set up in a direction. And even as this breaks down, you're going to know one of these sons is going to be Judah. And from Judah, at this point, Judah is going to be told that he is going to be the one who produces the Messiah. The Messiah is going to come through. And that's going to come down at this point. But they're all now in the blessing. It's now from Jacob. And why do we have to go through 1, 2, 3, into the fourth generation? But now it becomes a family. And that's worth noting. I didn't even ask that question. Why couldn't this all become one happy family? You know, like the tribes of Abraham. It's not the tribes. It's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then Jacob is now the tribes or the people. Why didn't it have to be Judah and the others are just all losers? You know, they're all just scattered like Keturah's sons were scattered. And then Judah, his sons become the nation of Israel. So it's interesting that we go one, one, and then we get here. Good enough, we'll take all 12 and they'll become a nation. Deal?
If Jacob hadn't received the promise or the blessing, though, then Jacob had the 12 sons.
Right.
So Esau, did he have 12 sons?
He would have had sons, too. I think
he had 12 sons?
We could find him.
Yeah, he did have 12 sons.
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like he did.
He did.
And let's just...
But right, the thing about it was in Romans 9, it talks about God choosing Jacob, actually. Right.
Right.
That's what I was kind of getting at.
Yeah. Yeah, that it wasn't. I mean, he was deceitful, but.
Right.
But it fit into God's plan. In what I mean.
How it all works is, again, another interesting situation. Right. So, and then that promise can only come through, it couldn't come through both Esau and Jacob, it had to come through one of them. Esau had a family. He became his own people. And when Jacob meets him, he's got possessions. I mean, he's got stuff. Yeah, so I think here, when it talks about blessing, I think we maybe need to reinterpret that. I guess that's what I'm doing right now, reinterpreting that and saying, instead of just, you bless you, we bless you, or pray for you. It was actually a promise of what it's going to be.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, chapter 49. I just want to do this, and it may be a mistake. I made a mistake on Sunday trying to go through the family of the sons of Ham. If you want to hear the worst message ever, go online, listen to Sunday's message. It's kind of like, and I knew it was better when I walked back by Tony, go, and she goes, and it was okay. It's kind of like, and as I asked, well, how'd it go? It's kind of like, yeah. But anyway, I did do that. And I'm going to maybe do it again here. Some stuff is so interesting. You know, when you study it and you tie it all together, you have to start telling it to people. They're kind of like, I thought, you know, I was watching people look at, you know, like wrestling flyers and things. I'm like, no, that's not bad. What is that? It's a brochure about a wrestling camp. It's like, this is really bad. I wasn't blaming the people at all. It's kind of like, I would probably be out getting a drink or something. But anyway, here we go, chapter 49. Because in these obscure verses, or in these genealogies, there's treasures are hidden there. And sometimes you don't know you got a treasure until, you know, several weeks later. So I think people just got a real big dose of a treasure. And I don't think they. I just wait for God to bless it. Okay, chapter 49. Then Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather around so I can tell you what will happen to you in days to come." Now that's pretty exciting stuff right there. These are what's going to happen to these 12 sons. Here we go. Verse 2. "Assemble and listen, sons of Jacob. Listen to your father Israel." So he apparently is in a prophesying mode. I mean, it's almost as if he's now, what we'd say, under the influence of the Spirit. He's now rolling with a poetic, prophetic a pronouncement here. He addresses first Reuben. "Reuben, you're my firstborn." Now that should have been the one who received some kind of major inheritance. "My might, the first sign of my strength, excelling in honor, excelling in power. But turbulent as waters, you will no longer excel. For you went up into your father's bed, into my couch, and defiled it." He went and slept with one, not his mother, but he slept with one of Jacob's wives. And so, boom, he's out. He was the first sign of strength, but he failed. Reuben is next, the second two, son number 2 and 3. Now this is kind of, just think about this as we go through this. This is him calling his son. He's on his deathbed and he calls his sons forward. He says, "I'm going to speak to you about your future. And this is what God thinks of you. This is what I think of you. You are on the right track. You are strong. But, whoops, you're out. Simon and Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are weapons of violence." Now you know the story, Simeon and Levi. When they're, again, justify it, their daughter Dinah, their sister Dinah was raped by Sechem. Here we go, you got Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea. Sechem was one of these cities right about in here. And they're camped out here at their camp, all their people. And Jacob had just come back from a Paddan Aram. And a man named Sechem, from Sechem, a Hivite, one of the descendants of Ham, I know that because of Sunday's message, loved Dinah, was attracted to Dinah, and actually raped her with intentions of marrying her. Well, Levi and Simeon decided, and they said, "Well, we want to marry. Sitch wants to marry Dinah," which was an honorable thing for a Hivite to come and say that. And they said, "Well," they said, we can't have you marry with us because we're separated. You're not of our family." They said, "What do we need to do to be like you and trade with you?" They said, "Well, you're going to enter our covenant." Now they're using the covenant of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, saying, "Well, you've got to enter into our covenant." "Well, how?" "Yeah, sure. What is that?" "Circumcision. Guys, you got to get circumcised." And they're using, Simeon and Levi are using the covenant of God as a means of manipulating the city of Sechem. They go, "Well, we'll talk about it at our council meeting tonight." So they had a council meeting. Everybody goes, "Well, we'll get a trade of these people. Are wealthy. They still got Abraham and Isaac's inheritance and some possessions. Jacob's." The guy's like, let's do that. So they said, "We'll get circumcised. We'll enter the covenant with you." Well, when they got circumcised, Simeon and Levi said, "Okay, we're attacking today." So they take up, when all the men, I think they said it was a couple days later, they went up and attacked the city, killed all the men, hamstrung the horses, meaning they cut the back legs, they're worthless, and then just let loose their fury, their anger. Now again, we need to stop right here. Levi has a son, what's his name? forget his name, and he has a son named Amram, who has a son named Moses and Aaron. There's a son missing right here, I forget his name. But nonetheless, my point, Levi is mentioned right here on a section. Well, let's read on. Their swords are weapons of violence. They didn't use them for violence. Is Hamas. That's unjust punishment, unjustness. It's all kinds of physical abuse, of mental abuse, social abuse. They use their power, Hamas. Let me not enter their council. I don't want advice from these two guys. I don't want to see the world from their vantage point. Let me not join their assembly. For they have killed men in their anger. Now notice the difference there. God is going to have many times where he's going to order men to be killed. But these guys are killing not because it's right, not because they're doing vengeance, but they're angry. And they're under Hamas. They're in violence. And hamstrung oxen as they pleased. Cursed be their anger so fierce, and their fury so cruel. And again, that of course, with four generations, you can possibly, and again, this is just a suggestion, you can possibly see the remains of that anger in Moses, who was raised in Amram's house until he was 3 years old. You may remember that. Sometimes when fathers become angry, it's transferred to their sons. And Moses demonstrated on several occasions uncontrolled anger. Now you can try and make it into a hero if you want to, but he killed the slave master with his bare hands because he got mad. He then comes down after, you know, I know it's a great scene in the movie, but God had no intention of Moses smashing the Ten Commandments. God writes them with his own finger, gives them to Moses to take the people. Moses goes down and gets ticked off at the people and smashes, so it's a little baby fit there on the side of Mount Sinai, and smashes the Ten Commandments. How do you know God was upset? Because he had Moses come up and says, we're going to do that again. This time, I'll read them to you, and you carve them in stone. God didn't do it. God, first one, written with the finger of God. The second one, Moses chiseled. And then if you still have any questions, Moses strikes the rock the second time when God said, speak to it. And water flowed because God said, I want to honor you as holy before, be holy before the people. But Moses, come here. I think I said, speak to the rock. I know, but I was really ticked. Because Moses says very clearly, we read it, it's really funny. Because God says, go out, face the rock, and speak to it. Moses went out, faced the people, and spoke to them, and calls them rebels, and turns and strikes the rock. It's kind of like, okay, close enough. Here's water for the people. Moses, we need to talk. You're not going to the promised land. I've had enough of this anger. So in other words, it's just interesting that that anger may have made it through four generations. That's just a side. But anyway, Simeon and Levi, cursed be their anger, and their fury so cruel, I will scatter them in Jacob and disperse them in Israel. Now, they were not given any, and we talked about this, I think, one night here, I think. They were not given any land in the, when they divide the land up. Levi, of course, remember, they become the priestly tribe. And this is an example of turning cursing to blessing, because when Moses comes down off the mountain, there's a huge wild party going on, a revolt going on, and he says, who's on the Lord's side? And the tribe of Levi comes over and says, we'll fight, and they pull out their swords, same family, Moses' family, and they begin to kill. They killed, I don't know how many, but it was like a couple thousand at least, slaughtered Israelites, just killed them, and they took control, like, they're like a police force in the middle of a chaotic situation, and took control of the crowd of Israel. And God says, thank you, and now I will have you, will be my own portion. I'll put you in the temple in Jerusalem. They never got any land. They were placed as the priesthood in the temple, and all the tribes brought them a tithe or provisions to feed the tribe of Levi because they were God's portion. So there's an example of turning cursing into blessing. They're not given any land, but they are given, again, position. Simeon was absorbed into Judah, basically. Anyway, that's where they go. Okay, next one, verse 8. Judah, the fourth son. We've only got 9 to go. Your brothers will praise you. Your hand will be on the neck of your enemies. So far, so good. Your father's sons will bow down to you. Wow. So that's brothers. That's the sons. That's everyone. I mean, we're naming the whole family, the whole line coming. You are a lion's cub, O Judah, the lion of the tribe of Judah. You return from the prey, my son. You return from the battle. Like a lion, he crouches and lies down. Like a lioness, who dares rouse him? And here's the big verse right here, verse 10. The scepter, that's the ruler's object, the scepter, will not depart from Judah. No way is it leaving Judah. So this is like, this is not something they've earned or deserved. This is now a pronouncement. The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet. And in those days, they'd have a scepter they'd hold, and they'd have a staff they put between their longer staff they'd hold between their feet as they sat on the throne, which indicated they were the power. Until he comes to whom it belongs. The obedience of the nations is his. Look at that huge verse. We're talking about the little tribes, a family down here in Egypt. They're down in Egypt. Now Jacob is in Egypt and he's getting ready to die. And he's blessing his 12 sons, or speaking to them about their future. In a sense, giving them promises, some good promises, some bad promises. And when he talks about Judah, he says, the scepter will not depart from the tribe of Judah until it comes to one it belongs to. And, again, right here, watch this. And the obedience of the nations is his. In other words, it's not just a family promise, not just about Israel. The vision is, this is such a huge vision that Jacob is speaking here. He sees someone coming from Judah ruling all of the nations. Huge, huge vision. He will tether his donkey to the vine, his colt to the choicest branch. He will wash his garments in wine, his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes will be darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. So those are all positive. And he ends up, eating and drinking and bathing and washing his clothes. I mean, everything's in abundance. Probably speaking of even the millennial kingdom itself, or the kingdom of the tribe of Judah, or the line of the tribe of Judah. Verse 13. Zebulun will live by the seashore and become a haven for ships. His border will extend towards Sidon. And definitely, that's where right up in here. He's going to be up in here, and he's going to be doing business with Sidon. We can see that later on. Issachar is a, in other words, Zebulun is going to be busy with business. Issachar is a raw-boned donkey lying down between two saddlebags. When he sees how good is his resting place and how pleasant is his land, he will bend his shoulder to the burden and submit to forced labor. In other words, Issachar is going to get a good portion right here, and he's going to say, hey, this is good enough. He's going to be just like a donkey who lays down. They put two saddlebags on it. He's just going to lay down and say, he'll accept the burden, says, hey, if I get to stay here, live here, eat this food, strap it on me, I'm fine. And Issachar is going to, that's all of it. I just want you to notice the difference in personalities of these sons, from falling to immorality, to having an anger problem, to being the ruler tribe, to being one who's going to go up on the seashore and begin trading with the Gentile nations, to one who's going to say, hey, I'm fine, let the Canaanites oppress me, as long as we get food, we're fine. Dan, interesting verse about Dan. Also, this is real quickly. Dan was given this allotment right by the Philistines. It got too tough, and they decided one day we're moving up here. And they moved up here. And they went to a land that was called a land that was peaceful and unsuspecting. They conquered the people of Lachish here, and they said, this is beautiful. It was one of the nicest places we went to. There's water abundance there. There's green up there. Beautiful place. And it looked really nice. But the problem was, when you look at history, this was where the main road coming through Israel, when the invaders came, they always came. The first tribe always defeated Dan. So they were right down here. All they had to do was drive out the Philistines, and they're ready to go. Too hard. Let's go up here. And for the rest of history, they get overrun by all the invaders. Kind of almost ironic. Dan will provide justice for his people as one of the tribes of Israel. This is where Samson comes from. Dan will be some people really get strung out on this verse. Dan will be a serpent by the roadside, a viper along the path that bites the horse's heels, so that his rider tumbles backward. Now, what does that mean? Some people think that's a verse, even speaking about the Antichrist. Just the tribe, the Antichrist is going to come. The snake, the viper is going to come through here. Anyway. I look for your deliverance, O Lord. That's Jacob, right? You see it right here? Okay, maybe this again. Verse 17 and 18 together. Jacob says, Dan will be a serpent by the roadside, a viper along the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider tumbles backwards. So you may be talking about the Messiah, maybe talking about the Antichrist coming in, or the Messiah being knocked off the horse or something like this, some kind of problem. But notice right here, verse 18, Jacob then says, I look for your deliverance, O Lord. Remember, he talks later on in the book of the Old Testament about the time of Jacob's trouble, the tribulation. Here's Jacob, after reading about Dan, he says, I look for your deliverance. Speaking of, he's going to be dead. He's not going to, what's he talking about? He's looking into the future, seeing what Dan is going to bring about, whatever it is, and saying, I'm waiting for deliverance from what Dan is going to bring to us. Verse 19, Gad will be attacked by a band of raiders, but he will attack them at their heel. Meaning he'll be overrun, but he'll pursue. He was up north to Asher's. Food will be rich. He will provide delicate fit for a king. Naphtali, these are all up north. Naphtali is a doe set free that bears beautiful fawns. Now we come to Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful vine. A fruitful vine near a spring. Now, real quickly as we look at this, Joseph is going to settle. Well, he's not going to really get any land because it's going to be split into two parts, Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh is going to end up being on both sides here, and the hill country of Ephraim is going to be in this area here just north of Benjamin. So this whole area is going to end up being, in a sense, Joseph, a large portion of land. A fruitful vine near a spring whose branches climb over a wall. With bitterness, archers attack him. They shoot at him with hostility, but his bow remained steady. His strong arms stayed limber because of the hand of the mighty one of Jacob, because of the shepherd, the rock of Israel, because of your father's God who helps you, because of the Almighty who blesses you with blessing of the heavens above and blessings, watch this, blessings of the deep that lies below, blessings of the breast and womb. Your father's blessings are greater than the blessings of the ancient mountains, than the bounty of the age-old hills. Let all these rest on the head of Joseph, on the brow of the prince among his brothers. Now, we're just in passing right here, with blessing of the heavens above and blessing of the deep that lies below. There are people today following these verses and other verses, include Moses, does something similar. And they use these verses to try and find out, I don't know if we mentioned this before, to try and find out where those blessings of the deep are. And what is the blessings of the deep in our day? Oil. And so there's groups of people using the Old Testament scriptures to try and locate. You can tell where these tribes are at. The borders are given in scriptures. And they'll use, when they mention the deeps or the treasures of the deep, they are currently, right now, drilling and looking for oil in those locations. And many people think, at least it's worth considering, that Israel in the near future is going to strike oil. That is going to cause them to become fabulously wealthy. That's going to help build this peace, because in Ezekiel 38, Ezekiel 38-39, when Magog comes down, when Gog leads Magog down with Persia and Libya coming in with them, they're coming down to plunder the wealth of Israel. And that wealth is probably more than just, the plains of Armageddon, where they got their crops. It's probably, maybe could be the oil. And that could establish a lot of things right there. So anyway, they're looking for that right now. One of the rabbis said this. He said, the question we've got for God is, if he gave us the promised land, and this is the land the Lord chose for us, that why did he choose the only part of the Middle East that didn't have oil? Because you got oil all around it except right here. And that kind of leads to the question, like, well, I don't think he did. You just haven't got it yet. I mean, why would God do that? There's a time coming, possibly. Yeah, that's speculation, and they're getting that out of some of these verses. Verse 27. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey. In the evening he divides the plunder. Kind of a dangerous verse about Benjamin. You got two guys from the Bible that come from the tribe of Benjamin that you can are familiar with, King Saul, and then Saul of Tarshish. All of these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and mentions those right there. Now, one more thing takes place here that we got to talk about, because that is his blessing, his 12 sons. But coming from his 12 sons, there's something important that on his death now, he's going to do something more. He's going to take Jacob, is going to take Joseph, and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, and that is what Hebrews is talking about. It says, when he was Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons. That's what we just read. Blessed each of Joseph's sons, worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. And let's go back to chapter 48. If you don't mind, here we go again. Are you okay? Chapter 48, verse 1. Sometime later, Joseph was told, your father is ill. So he took his two sons, Joseph did, Manasseh and Ephraim, along with him. When, now notice, I wrote Ephraim and Manasseh. It should be Manasseh and Ephraim. And the reason I say Ephraim and Manasseh is you're going to find out here, because Ephraim is going to be given prominence. It's like Jacob and Esau. It really is Esau and Jacob, but because the blessing got switched, and here it goes again. Manasseh and Ephraim along with him. Then when Jacob was told, your son Joseph has come to you, Israel rallied his strength and sat up on the bed. Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan, and there he blessed me and said to me, and this, remember, when Jacob was younger, he went up north and fled from Esau. This was on his way up to Paddan Aram. God said to him, I'm going to make you fruitful and will increase your numbers. Now remember, when Jacob flees, he's already received the inheritance and the blessing or the promise from Abraham. But as he's fleeing, God comes to him and says, hey, listen, I am going to make you fruitful and will increase your numbers. I will make you a community of peoples, and I will give this land as an everlasting possession to your descendants after you, confirming the promises he got from his father Isaac. Verse 5, now then, your two sons, watch this, born to you in Egypt before I came to you here, will be reckoned as mine. And possibly the reason this is mentioned here in Hebrews, and the reason Jacob brings Joseph in and takes these two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, and brings them in, is because all of the other 12, or all the other 11 brothers, all of their wives would then have produced for him legitimate grandchildren, meaning legitimate in the sense of being of our people. Joseph married an Egyptian, and an Egyptian wife. And so in a sense, Egypt could claim these, and if Egypt is, in this case, from Mesraim, which is the word in the chapter 10 of Genesis for Egypt, from the tribe of Ham. You got to listen to the message. You got a lot of good stuff in it. Is Egypt. This would be Ham, you see. Would be Ham's descendant. This is Shem's descendant, or the line of Abraham. And Joseph, or Jacob, is then saying, they will be mine. I'm taking these, then they're in our lineage. I'm going to claim them, I'm going to bless them, I'm going to lay my hands on them, and they are no longer associated with this side of the family tree. Potentially. Before I came to you, they were born, they'll be reckoned as mine. Ephraim and Manasseh will be mine. He says it twice. Just as Reuben and Simeon are mine, any children born to you after them will be yours. In the territory they inherit, they will be reckoned under the names of their brothers. In other words, you have more sons, they're going to have to live with somebody else. But I'm going to claim these two, and they're going to take allotments that possibly would have gone to Simeon or Reuben, or in this case, Simeon and Levi. As I was returning from Paddan, to my sorrow, Rachel died in the land of Canaan while we were still on the way, a little distance from Ephrath. Now, it's interesting that he's an old man, he's dying, and he's still the thing he's still sorrowful about is the death of the woman that he loved. So I buried her there beside the road to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. When Israel saw the sons of Joseph, he asked, who are these? Now, notice again, he sees them, he says, who are these? Or who are these? In other words, remember when Jacob came to Isaac, he told him, well, I'm Esau, but he was lying. So he says, he probably knows who they are, but it's like, okay, let's have it. Who are these? They are the sons God has given me here, Joseph said to his father. Then Israel said, bring them to me so I may bless them. Now Israel's eyes were failing because of his old age, and he could hardly see. Now again, Israel is Jacob. So Joseph brought his sons close to him, and his father kissed them and embraced them. Israel said to Joseph, I never expected to see your face again. And you know the story. Jacob never thought he'd ever see that. Joseph was dead. And now God has allowed me to see your children too. What a blessing. Then Joseph removed them from Israel's knee. Then Joseph removed them from Jacob's knees and bowed down with his face to the ground. And Joseph took both of them, Ephraim on his right toward Israel's left. So this is the second son. Okay, you got this? This is Joseph. This is Jacob. This is Joseph's right side, but it's Jacob's left side. This is Jacob's side of dominance right here. So Joseph's going to put his son of dominance, the first son, which would be Manasseh, right here for his father to bless on the right side, and Ephraim for him to bless on the left side. You got that? That's why it's saying this. Then Joseph removed them from Israel's knees, bowed down with his face to the ground, and Joseph took both of them, Ephraim on his right toward his father's left, and Manasseh on his left towards his father's right hand and brought them close to him. He kind of moves them in for his father to bless them. Bless the oldest son, father. Here's the passing of the blessing. The passing of the blessing's coming right here. But Israel, or Jacob, reached out his right hand and put it on Ephraim. No! Put it on Ephraim's head, though he was the younger, and crossing his arms, he put his left hand on, oops, missed the arrow here, on Manasseh. Manasseh's head, even though Manasseh was the firstborn. Then he blessed Joseph and said, may God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel, that would be the second member of the Trinity, the theophany, who has delivered me from all of them, may he bless these boys, may they be called by my name, and the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. I mean, that's a huge statement right there. I mean, he's going back to Abraham, Isaac, and says, may they be in the line of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Ephraim and Manasseh. And may they increase greatly upon the earth. Verse 17. When Joseph saw his father placing his right hand on Ephraim's head, he was displeased. The same way, Abraham was not pleased when Ishmael was rejected. Isaac was not pleased when he blessed Jacob instead of Esau. Now Jacob is blessing the wrong one, and Joseph is not pleased. It's like, Dad wanted Ishmael, Dad wanted Esau, now Dad wants Manasseh. But God chooses Isaac, God chooses Jacob, and God chooses here, he chooses Ephraim. He was not pleased, he was displeased, so he took hold of his father's hand to move it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. Joseph is actually reaching in and going, no, we're going to bless this one. He's actually taking, it's like God is in the middle of the promise, and he's looking at the angle, we're going to put it over here on this guy. Joseph said to him, no, my father, this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head. But his father refused and says, I know, my son, I know. He too will become a people, and he too will become great. Not like Esau in the sense that he's going to be cut off completely, because he's in the family. He's in the 12 tribes. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will become a group of nations. He blessed them that day and said, in your name will Israel pronounce this blessing. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. So he put Ephraim ahead of Manasseh. Then Israel said to Joseph, I am about to die, but God will be with you and take you back to the land of your fathers. And to you as one who is over your brothers, I give the ridge of land I took from the Amorites with my sword and my bow. That's an interesting verse right there. We're not going to go into it, but it's like we're not real sure what that means. There's a ridge of land that he took from the Amorites that he fought for. It's not the cave of Machpelah that Abraham bought. It's not the land that he buried Rachel on. It's not the city of Shechem that his brother or his sons fought, unless Jacob fought with his sons to take that land. I think it's something that's just been lost possibly in history, and the commentators talk about that. Nonetheless, that is it. Let's go back to Hebrews 11. I want to look at this very quickly. Hebrews 11. Show you something in here, just so you know it's there. And then we better quit for the night. Gosh, sorry. In Hebrews chapter 11, I'm going to read this for you right here, verse 21. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons. That's what we just read. And worshiped as he leaned on the top of his staff. Now, just so you know, I'm trying to find these in the notes or somewhere. Where are we at here? Yeah, on the bottom of page 1. If you go back and you read in chapter 47, verse... I'm going to go back to 47, verse 31, and read it to you in Genesis. 47, verse 31. And it's before he started blessing Ephraim and Manasseh. It says this, swear to me, he said, then Joseph swore to him, and Israel worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. Now that is what it says in the NIV Bible. That is what we've got over here. Excuse me. That is not what we have over here in Hebrews chapter 11. It says, and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. So we've got two words here. We've got the word, just so you know this, this is not going to change your life or anything. Staff and bed. You see in your notes right there, the word for bed is the word on the bottom of page one. The word for bed in the Hebrew is M-I-T-T-A-H. The word for staff is the word M-A-T-T-E-H. Now here we go. You remember the Masoretic text, Masoretic text. This was the text that was handed down to us, the Hebrew scriptures handed down to us that we use even to translate the NIV Bible, many Bibles did, Masoretic text. It was handed down from the Jews. They kept copying the Hebrew scriptures. Our oldest copy of this is right around 900 AD. That's our oldest manuscript. But we're also talking about the Septuagint. Septuagint, okay? The Septuagint was translated from the Hebrews into Greek around 200 BC. In the Septuagint, they took this word right here, the mitta now, okay, are you still with me? At this time, the Hebrew letters only used the consonants. There were no vowels in the original Hebrew scriptures, just consonants. And so in 200 BC, when the Greeks read the Hebrew scriptures, they had to provide the vowels for that word. So in 200 BC, they says, this is the word staff. And they put in here an A and an E, which made this word mean staff in 200 BC. And that is what we have here in the book of Hebrews. Because remember, the writer of Hebrews is quoting what translation? He's quoting the Septuagint, the Greek translation that these people are writing, and they translated that as staff. Now, the Masoretic text continued to have just the consonants until around between 500 and 800 BC, or AD, they added consonants. And when they came, they didn't pay attention to the Septuagint, they says this word right here, this is the word bed. And so they put the letter I and the letter A here. And so in our Masoretic text of what our Old Testament, my NIV is based on, and the King James New American Standard is using the Masoretic text, it says back in Genesis that Jacob leaned on his bed, or on the corner of his bed, and worshiped God. But when you get over to Hebrews, it's not, he's not leaning on his bed. He gives the impression that he's powering himself and leaning up on his staff and still worships God in a last moment of strength as he worships on his staff. So you got two different translations. Now, is that an error in the manuscripts? No, because both the manuscripts are saying this. Both manuscripts are saying M-T-T-H. That is clearly what it says. There's not an error. It now comes down to interpretation. In the Greeks in 200 BC interpreted by putting the vowels in here in 900, 500 to 800 BC, AD. The Jews put different vowels in there. So either way, you guys got to work with what you've got there. And that is the account of Jacob. Now, the important thing here, we got to pick this up next week because I've gone long enough here, is that, and we'll mention this again next week as we start, is Jacob then dies in Egypt. And the whole thing could be over with. Listen, they are in Egypt. They could marry into the Egyptians and they could dissolve and be gone from history. You see how easy that would be. At this point, they've got 70-some people plus some kids that they've had born there. They marry into the Egyptians, and that is the tribe of Abraham. Marries into the tribes of Ham, and then they're gone. But Jacob says, no. When I die, and it's going to be just a few days later, take me back and bury me in the cave of Machpelah that my father bought from the Amorites, or the Hittites. And they do. Joseph, at the end of Genesis, says the same thing. When I die, don't bury me here because God is going to come and get us. And the amazing thing is, during a period of some 400 years then, that tribe of people in Egypt, who could have just been absorbed in there, they remained individual, as an individual group of people away from the Egyptians, working with them, become slaves, as you know. But when they come out with guess whose body? You know, Joseph's body is in a sarcophagus that they carry with them out. It's mentioned when they come out of the land, and it's mentioned when they enter the land. So Joseph's body, we're going to read that next week, is taken out of the land. It's in the land of Egypt. It comes out with Moses. It's carried around in the wilderness for 40 years. And when they come into the promised land, if they conquer the land, one of the first things they do is bury him. And they buried Joseph, not in the cave of Machpelah, but in the land that Jacob gave right there. It says, I give you this land. They find that land that he fought with his sword, and they bury Joseph there in the land of the promised land, and of course the rest is history. But that is how strong that promise was. Abraham, who never saw it, but told his son Isaac, who never saw it, but told his son Jacob, who never saw it, but told his sons, and then he dies, and then Joseph and all of his sons die in Egypt, but they handed down, and only they had their word of God. Probably had some kind of manuscripts that they had for some of Genesis is based on. But the thing that they had for 400 years was Joseph's sarcophagus. Joseph is going back to this land. And the remembrance, they had no idea how they're going to get there. Had no idea how they're going to make it. In fact, when it came time to go, a lot of them didn't want to leave. They didn't want to be slaves, but they certainly didn't want to live in the wilderness and eat manna. And so you just see God's divine hand. Again, the promise that we're talking about right there is a promise that wasn't ever fulfilled in their lives, but they were waiting for. We'll continue next week. Father, we do thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the chance to look into it. We do so we might compare our lives to these historical events, that we would see you working in our lives just as we see you working throughout history. Again, I thank you, Father, for this chance to look into your word and ask that you may continue to lead and guide us in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Questions or thoughts?
Kohath.
Very good. Mother was Levi, Kohath, Amram, and Moses.
Yeah. I know the 400 is kind of
the 400. Yeah, it'd be depending on when you start counting, like with right. Joseph and stuff, and then of course Moses living 120 years,
right.
And then you got that line of who are the kind, because there would have been more sons born there.
Yeah, like Levi had Gershon, Kohath, and Merari.
Yeah, and they would have. So I mean, there's probably some, and sometimes they leave. There's some of the genealogy, they appear to have gaps, and they just pick out people. But again, it did say four generations, that you're going to be in the land for four, you know, he told Abraham four generations, and he said 400 years. So he puts four generations and 400 years. And again, at that time, the generations, I think, were considered 100 years because they're living longer. Any other thoughts? Hey, Tony's not here. No. But you know, every time Tony's not here, I forget to turn that recorder on. Every time. Too many things on. No, I didn't record it. I forgot. I got it all set up and it was working. I checked a couple times to see if it was flashing. It was.
But
I didn't push the record button.
Start over.
Yeah. Can you do that one more time? No, but we've got ice cream bars.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. A couple more weeks.